I'm Alex Beam. This is The Connection. The issue of litigation is front and center as Congress debates the patient's Bill of Rights today. Conservatives fear a flood of frivolous lawsuits if consumers are empowered to sue their HMOs. Healthcare providers allege that costs will increase and services will suffer should the litigation provision pass. This begs two questions. Will this mythical mountain of lawsuits actually materialize? And if so, would it really be a bad thing? Many on the right violently oppose lawsuits in general, claiming they cripple corporations to no positive end. Others argue that lawsuits are society's last and best defense against corporate misdeeds, and the citizen's right to sue is an indispensable tool of our American democracy. Lawsuits, can't live with them, can't live without them. Connection listeners, have lawsuits gotten out of hand, or are they simply keeping the scales of justice in balance? Does litigation make our society a better, safer place to live? Or is it just line the pockets of attorneys at our expense? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join our show online at theconnection.org. I'm joined in the studio today by Carl T. Bogus, an associate professor at Roger Williams University School of Law, and the author of the provocatively titled book, Why Lawsuits Are Good for America. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you, Alex.
It's great to have you. I love this title. It's like Why Drinking Strychnine Can Make You a Better Person. This book should be flying off the shelves. Obviously, our point of departure is, why are lawsuits good for America?
Well, I believe that lawsuits, that is the common law system where citizens can file lawsuits against corporations that have injured them, that this system is a important and increasingly important backup system of regulation. The administrative agencies, whether it's FDA and pharmaceuticals or the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration in cars, is the first line of defense in regulating safety. But they can't do the job alone. They are increasingly compromised politically, and the common law system, therefore, is an important backup system.
Now, you think that in our society today, lawsuits are, in effect, an instrument of public policy.
Yes, they are an instrument of public policy, and one that's very well suited to our system of government because they include a democratic element, the jury system, a disciplined form of democracy.
Now, one of the interesting things about your book, it's very clearly written. It's for the layperson, which helped me a great deal. But in the relatively short history of America, the things that we take for granted, like suing a company that may have sold you a defective product, there's a fairly recent history here. Can you sketch the background, how we got to this position?
Well, I guess there are a couple of watershed events. One is that the founders, James Madison and the founders of the Republic, created a third branch of government, being the judiciary. And it was really unprecedented in a cultural way to have judges and courts participate in public policy making, and they do. They do in America more so than they do in any other country I'm aware of, and certainly than they did in England at the time of the founding of the Republic or today. That's one watershed event. The other is the growth of the tort system, that is suits for civil wrongs, which was born in England, but in common law England, but it was a flea on an elephant's back in the law. It was very, very small, and it was the growth of the Industrial Revolution that led to lots of worker injuries, and the transcontinental railroad system that led to lots of worker industries, that really produced a robust, over time, produced a robust tort system in America.
What's fascinating is that basically a railroad engine hit you in 1860, you were out of luck, but then there's a progression in balancing those equities. Can you explain that?
It is. It's a very interesting history. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and when the railroad system was embryonic, and there was a need to create a large railroad system in the United States and a race to create a transcontinental railroad system, the courts, originally led, by the way, by the Massachusetts courts, created a series of doctrines to protect defendants, to protect factory owners, to protect railroads from lawsuits. One was called the co-worker rule, and that is if you were injured as a result of a co-worker's negligence, that negligence was attributed to you and you couldn't sue. And naturally, everybody was injured as a result of somebody's negligence. So that effectively barred most lawsuits. Over time, as the railroads and the industries became powerful and economically viable, the courts changed the doctrine and permitted lawsuits.
Now, why?
Well,
because the railroads were still powerful, right? Surely they owned legislatures as well as congressmen.
The railroads were still powerful. They did, as you put it, own legislatures. It was difficult or impossible to get changes of the law through the legislature. Railroads gave, for example, legislators free passes on railroads, among many other things. One of the beauties of the common law system is that it is far more insulated from politics than is legislative politics, where the members have to stand for election and raise money. It was the horrific worker injuries that created the pressure on the courts to make changes.
So there was essentially popular and political pressure, is what you're saying?
I think more than popular and political pressure, it was judges seeing what was happening and seeing the results of their prior legal rules they created, and seeing families come into court with the breadwinner killed or maimed, quadriplegic, without any form of support that impelled them to make the change. It wasn't so much political as it was sound public policy.
Now, how do we move from that period of the railroads to the present day, where there's almost this presumption that any David can leap into court against any corporate Goliath? What happened, say, 40 years ago or so in the world of products liability that has brought us to this kind of perplexing place where we are now?
Well, a number of things. I'm not sure it's as perplexing as portrayed, but one of the things that allows average citizens that don't have financial resources or connections to take on the most powerful elements in society, for John Q. Citizen to sue General Motors, is the contingent fee system. And the contingent fee system allows someone who has been injured and who a lawyer believes has a good case, a case that's likely to in which they're likely to prevail, the lawyer will take the case on and say, I will not charge you anything. I will take my fee from whatever I recover from the defendant. That makes it possible for average citizens to hire top legal talent and take on the most powerful elements in our society on almost equal terms.
You write in your book about what you call the myth of the monster lawsuit. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, I think so. We have this feeling that the lawsuits are burgeoning, that they're spinning out of control, that there is enormous growth in civil litigation, and that's simply not supported by the data. There is not great growth in civil litigation. In fact, in most aspects of the tort system, products liability, I believe medical malpractice.
I'm going to interrupt you. Isn't it in fact true that there are many more lawsuits filed today, say, than 10 years ago?
Not many more. There are more, and the growth is in business lawsuits, in corporations suing other corporations, not in individuals suing corporations.
So, okay, go on.
We have this view that there are far more lawsuits. In fact, there are not. Not more than there were a decade ago or two decades ago, except in the one category of corporations suing each other for breach of contract, et cetera.
Okay. Connection listeners, if you want to join us to talk about the litigation myth with Professor Bogus, you can call us at 1-800-423-8255. We have Ken joining us by car phone.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi, Ken.
How you doing? I'm a lawyer. I'm actually heading in my car now to a deposition on latex glove litigation.
Whoa.
I wanted to chime in for a minute because it's really interesting. I have a background of working in insurance for insurance companies for 11 years before I became a litigator, and now I've been working for 10 years as a litigator running my own firm. And I do both defense work and plaintiff work, and I couldn't concur more with your guest that the numbers are extraordinarily down. He's correct. Almost all cases that have increased, the numbers have been contract cases in courts. If you look at the numbers, for take Massachusetts, for instance, I believe last year's study by Lawyers Weekly indicated out of the average verdict in most counties was significantly lower. For instance, Norfolk County, $19,000. Essex County, $17,000 verdicts. There was approximately 23 out of 30,000 Superior Court case filings, again, down in Superior Court filings for 5 years in a row.
Now, what's driving these down, Ken?
Well, I think it's a number of reasons. You have a lot of corporate America's done a tremendous job, in my opinion, of polluting the jury pools, of believing cases like the coffee case you started out with, and it couldn't be further from the truth. My response always to people when they say frivolous lawsuits, because there's many mechanisms your guests could tell you of cutting off cases when they're filed, for instance, what's called 12b6 motions and other motions, is that the corporate America and companies in general want the general public to believe the stuff is all going on. And I always say, give me the details. Let me look at the docket.
What about the juries you face, Ken? I've been on a jury myself, but I want to hear you. Do you find men and women have bought into what Professor Bogus calls the myth?
Overwhelmingly so. It takes a tremendous job on a plaintiff lawyer's ability, communication skills, to desensitize a jury immediately at the opening statements of a case because they believe all this stuff goes on. You have to desensitize them and say that the law is a very important mechanism in this country. It's called accountability for your actions.
Well, there has
it's not called it's not frivolous lawsuits. It's a bunch of baloney. When you do something wrong to someone, and you need to prove your case, and you can prove it in front of a jury, and they have elements in the law to prove it. You just can't willy-nilly walk into court. That's a fallacy. That's a fantasy land that's been created by corporate America to make you believe that this stuff goes on, when in fact it does not.
Ken makes a good point, and one of the reasons we believe what we believe today is that there has been now, for well over a decade, a concerted campaign by big business and by their political allies to persuade us that there is a litigation crisis.
Ken, thank you for your call. Good luck with your suit. I hope, Connection listeners, we're going to pick up with Professor Carl Bogus on the litigation myth when we come back. If you want to join our conversation, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Alex Beam. This is The Connection. We're devoting this hour to discussing plaintiffs' litigation, product liability litigation, and Carl Bogus's provocative thesis that lawsuits are good for America. We have Professor Carl Bogus in the studio with us, and joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C., two veteran litigator attorneys. We have Jack Olander, who has 40 years of trial experience and is a past president of the Washington, D.C. Bar Association. He's joining us from NPR. Jack, thank you for being with us. We also have Joseph Montedonico, a defense attorney with the firm of Montedonico, Hamilton, and Altman in Maryland, who's faced off against Jack Olander in lawsuits in Washington and elsewhere. Joseph, you there?
Yes, I am, Alex. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to have you both. You know, we started this show by talking a little bit about the so-called Patient's Bill of Rights that's hanging fire in Congress. I guess it might be debated today. How do we need to perceive that, Joseph? Is that going to do what the Republicans say and set off a, you know, purported brush fire of unnecessary litigation?
Alex, coming in from the defense side, and I do represent and have represented over the years HMOs. I represent the doctors' hospitals in medical malpractice litigation. My firm is in both Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. And I must tell you, this is my personal feeling. I do not believe any corporation, any individual is above the law and should have any type of privilege. So therefore, even as a defense attorney, I'm coming in and do not believe that HMOs should be cut out of having to eventually stand up and defend themselves in justified litigation. However, part of that bill that is proposed also deals with how a patient would be compensated. It also deals with the caps. I personally feel, doing this for 30-some years, that a jury is awarding $40 million in personal injury cases. It borders on ridiculous. You mentioned the coffee cup case where a woman received millions of dollars because she put a hot cup of coffee between her legs while she was driving, and a very sympathetic jury felt that the fast food institution made the coffee too hot. I think that sort of is showing the jury system works.
Joseph,
I think
you may not be familiar with the full facts of that McDonald's case. Let me take a moment and tell people what the facts were. We had a 79-year-old woman who ordered a cup of McDonald's coffee at a drive-through window. Mm-hmm. Who put the cup between her legs and spilled the coffee, and was severely burned. And on those, that's basically what people know. And it sounds wacky to give someone a lot of money for spilling coffee on themselves. But here are the facts that not everyone does know. McDonald's dispensed that coffee at somewhere between 180 and 190 degrees, which results in third-degree burns if you spill it on yourself. If you have a home coffee maker, the coffee is dispensed at about 140 degrees, and one is not injured if you spill coffee on yourself. McDonald's had 700 complaints of people who had severely burned themselves by spilling their coffee.
Yeah, can I bring Jack Olander in here for a moment? Jack, I know.
Yes.
What's your perspective on, let's focus on this one case, if that's convenient for you.
All right, Alex. An additional thing that Carl didn't get to in telling about the McDonald's case is the amount of the verdict was not paid. The judge drastically reduced the amount of the verdict, and the case was settled. And with my colleague Joe Monodonico talking about $40 million jury verdicts, typically those verdicts do not stand. What happens is the judge, the trial judge, gets the first crack at it, and he can grant a defense motion to either cut the verdict or order a new trial. And then the Court of Appeals judges get another crack at it. So these verdicts that make the newspaper headlines routinely are cut, and they are settled for much smaller amounts. The point that I think Joe Monodonico is missing is that it is the jury that is setting these amounts. The jury is the conscience of the particular community where the case is tried, and the jury gives its value, and then it is up to the judges in two tiers and maybe three tiers to say whether the jury has acted within reason in compliance with the evidence that's been produced in the case.
What do you think
so
of that,
system,
Joe? Because
well,
they're
know,
saying,
I,
in effect, that the sort of a de facto, that the system imposes a de facto cap on some of these awards.
Well, certainly in some cases, what Carl and Jack just indicated is correct, and that is if the case shocks the conscience of a trial judge, that judge has the right to reduce the verdict.
Well, Joe, it goes well beyond that, Joe. As you know, the standard on reducing jury verdicts is not as restrictive as shocks the conscience of a judge. And in fact, data show that 74% of all jury verdicts in excess of $1 million are reduced or entirely eliminated. And my own analysis of the large verdicts in 1 year showed that 78% of all of the total dollars awarded were eliminated.
Carl, I don't disagree with you, but isn't that showing a defect then in the jury system, where our jurors are made up of individuals who come into a jury who already have a bias against corporations, who already have a bias in many cases against doctors and hospitals,
healthcare providers? Joe, you've been listening to President Bush a little bit too much. That's his theory.
too much.
We Americans cannot trust our fellow citizens on the jury.
Well, but Carl just indicated that 70% of verdicts are set aside by
Well, a quick point here. There's a lot of research about jury biases. And in fact, contrary to a popular opinion, jurors have begin cases with generally an anti-plaintiff bias. They're suspicious of people coming into court looking for money, firstly. Secondly, the rate of agreement between judges and jurors in deciding cases is extremely high. In fact, higher than experts in various disciplines who observe the same cases.
Guys, I want to bring a caller in here. I knew that one big problem with the show is that, of course, lawyers are changed. They're trained to keep talking until the judge finally hits them on the head with the gavel. We have a caller from Nashua, New Hampshire, who might help reorient our discussion a little bit back towards patients' Bill of Rights. Sylvia, hi.
Hi. I don't know. I have to half smile and shake my head for a couple of things here. For one thing, America has a democracy for sure, but there are many other democracies in the world that don't do litigation the way we do. And the other thing I'm kind of smiling about is where a gentleman said there are no such thing as frivolous lawsuits. If you ask any man on the street, everybody knows it goes on. And it's changed America. You can't buy a product, a toy, that it doesn't tell you don't put this toy in your mouth, or you might, it's a swallowing hazard. And all sorts of things in our country are being tainted by lawsuits. You have playgrounds that have closed. I come from Canada, where my parents practiced medicine in Canada. I and my brothers and sisters practiced medicine in the United States. And in Canada, you do not have a system like this, which has much benefited the country. We don't have jury cases deciding. We have judges that decide these cases. There is no such thing as settling of a lawsuit. If you don't have a case good enough to go to court, you do not have a case. And in the United States, about 80% of medical malpractice, if not 90% of them, are settled outside of the court. Further,
what's the matter with that, Sylvia?
Well, because you have about way more cases because of it. And what I want to say is, from the plaintiff's side, or the person that's suing, they have absolutely nothing to lose. They go in there, they don't pay a lawyer a thing because of the contingency fee, which you do not have in Canada, to get paid by the hour.
Well, I have to correct a few things that Sylvia has.
Finish, please.
Yes, you may, Sylvia. Go ahead.
You do not have to pay anything to start the lawsuit in the United States. Further, if you, quote, lose the law case, you've not lost anything at all. In Canada, if you take up the time of the judge, and if they consider it to be a frivolous suit, they will fine not only the person suing, but the lawyer representing the person. Further, if you win the lawsuit in Canada, the other side has to pay your expenses. You know, down here, when we lose a lawsuit as a physician, our side pays all those expenses. Our malpractice insurance pays all those expenses.
Now you are a physician, Sylvia, right?
Pardon me?
You're a physician yourself.
I'm an obstetrician. And it's totally ruining medicine, in my view, in the United States. There's many of my colleagues that have absolutely no desire to continue in obstetrics past the age they can get out in terms of delivering babies. And, of course, I don't expect anything to change in the United States because who makes the laws? Who sets the agenda? It's the lawyers. Nobody else has any say in it.
Sylvia, you have a bit of the lawyer in you yourself because you're articulate and you keep on talking.
The only state that seemed to do anything about it was Indiana, who had a physician as a governor who actually put caps on it. You know, nobody wants to have people suffering, you know, in any way. We all agree that people that have things done wrong or incorrect or negligently to them needs to have some compensation for it. But you've got to admit, even lawyers, that it's gotten absolutely ridiculous.
Sylvia, thank you for your call. Jack, what's up here? Do you have a response to her?
Of course. I don't admit a thing that Dr. Sylvia has said. Dr. Sylvia, first of all, tells us that 80 to 90% of the malpractice suits are settled. Well, I don't know where she gets her statistics. I don't know if that's true or false, but my own experience in dealing with thousands of malpractice cases is that the strongest cases usually do indeed get settled without a trial. The cases that are somewhat weak are the ones usually that go to trial. So it's just good business on the part of the medical industry and the insurance industry to try to settle the cases that they feel they're going to lose anyway. And any lawyer that will embark on a malpractice case in these days when it costs tens of thousands of dollars to prosecute a malpractice case, if it's a frivolous case, that lawyer is a darn fool. And there aren't many lawyers practicing malpractice who are darn fools. They would go bankrupt if they filed frivolous cases. I know a little bit about obstetric malpractice. I tried the first successful multimillion-dollar obstetric malpractice case in this country. And I know that since that verdict in 1976, a lot of improvements have taken place in specific areas that have been exposed by medical malpractice suits. There have been improvements that I am convinced have come about only because of these suits. The hospitals and the doctors and their insurance companies have found it too expensive to...
Sylvia, can you briefly respond to Jack?
Well, yeah, for one thing, I don't think we practice obstetrics any better or any worse than Canada, and we do not have this problem in Canada with obstetrics. The medical malpractice in the 1970s in Canada was about 150 a year. It's gone up to about 3,000 a year, whereas down here it's anywhere from 40,000 to 100,000 in the United States. That's one thing. And secondly, I'm not talking about frivolous medical cases only. I'm talking about all sorts of lawsuits that are frivolous. And what I'm talking about in settlement, I know that half the time these cases are settled because it's too expensive to take them to court. The insurance company will save more money to settle it than they will to fight it in court. That's what I'm talking about. If that were not an issue and the other side had to pay, if it went to court and it didn't turn out the way that they wanted it to, and they had to pay the expenses, you better believe there would be less lawsuits happening.
Sylvia, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, Alex, I would ask Joe Monodonico, who has defended thousands of malpractice cases, do insurance companies throw money at plaintiffs to get rid of them? If so, Joe, I'm going to take on a lot of cases that I turn away.
Well, I think the what I've seen doing litigation for 30-some years is, unfortunately, I've seen the pendulum swing significantly to not more lawsuits. And I agree with Carl. I think the amount of lawsuits, as well as our caller, Ken, is down. However, the magnitude of lawsuits is up. That is the seriousness of it. And I feel that's because lawyers like myself and clients that I have, and not just corporations but individuals, have taken on the plaintiff's bar. And because we have fought over the years so many frivolous lawsuits, that today plaintiff's lawyers, who many of them get extremely wealthy, making millions and millions of dollars a year, tend to only want to take on the cases like the brain damage baby cases or the product liability cases where someone died or had a very serious injury. I mean, again, you've got to understand that that many plaintiffs, and I do not put Jack in this because I know what his fees are, but many plaintiffs' lawyers in this area take 50% of a settlement or an award, and then on top of that, whatever their costs are. So the poor plaintiff, who is the one who's injured, winds up in many cases with only 50% of what they get from a jury, if not less. And the other 50% lines a lawyer's pocket.
I have to make a couple. Let's
hear from Carl Bogus. We have Professor Bogus. Go ahead.
A couple of quick responses to some of the points that that Sylvia made. First of all, there are sanctions for frivolous lawsuits, and the lawyers can be sanctioned. That is, fined by the court if they file a frivolous lawsuit. Secondly. The best deterrent for there are frivolous lawsuits. It does happen, but it is not, I think, a large problem, and that is because it is economically unsound for lawyers working on a contingent fee basis to file a frivolous suit. They're going to lose a lot of money if that suit is not sound. By the way, the plaintiff's win rate for malpractice cases tried before juries or judges is 30%. So when someone like Jack brings a medical malpractice case, he has faith that that's a strong case, and that is the best check on frivolous lawsuits.
Joe Montedonico, I didn't hear you directly answer Jack Olander's question. Would one of your clients pay a man or woman just to go away, even if he or she didn't really have that strong a case?
Unfortunately, yes. That is the way some insurance companies, particularly commercial insurance companies, operate. They're looking at the bottom line. If they can settle a malpractice case for $100,000 rather than spend $75,000 defending it, they look at the bottom line.
Joe, thank you. We got to go to a quick break here. We're going to come back and talk about the pros and cons of plaintiffs and defendants litigation. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK to make the litigation connection. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Alex Beam. This is The Connection. This hour, we're debating the ultimately debatable, highly debatable proposition that lawsuits are good for you. I'm joined in the studio by law professor Carl Bogus, who's just written a book with that title, Why Lawsuits Are Good for America. Earlier in the hour, we were joined by Jack Olander, a malpractice attorney in Washington, D.C., and we had Joseph Montedonico, who has defended both hospitals and insurance companies. In the kinds of plaintiffs' litigations that we've been talking about. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Greg on the line.
Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Wright. I'm a chiropractic physician. I'm an accident reconstructionist, and I'm also an EMT. So I kind of see motor vehicle collisions from all angles. As a physician, very hesitant about getting involved in any type of motor vehicle litigation. But as it turns out, I'm finding patients with real injuries at very low speeds. Fortunately, I don't have to worry about the malpractice end of things. As a chiropractor, we're pretty uninvasive. But I've gotten involved in the whole litigation mess through expert testimony for patients who I believed at first could never be injured at low speeds, at speeds where there was no damage to cause, and in my own personal experience have experienced a lower speed collision and found that it was very painful and took me weeks to recover from.
What state do you practice in, Greg?
I practice here in Massachusetts, on Cape Cod in Harwich.
The Boston Globe has been doing a series on sort of allegedly shadowy practice of people who go out and get themselves deliberately injured and then chiropractics come into court. Do you feel that that's sort of harping on a narrow exception?
I would agree it is a narrow exception. I believe that most people who are injured or who are exposed to these collisions at low speeds have a 50-50 chance of getting injured. I know the medical and engineering literature is fraught with examples, not only from epidemiology, but also from the low-speed crash tests. And they're showing injuries in robust, you know, healthy young volunteers at speeds as low as 2.5 miles per hour. Now, those aren't serious injuries, to be sure, but we have deaths beginning in rear-end collisions at speeds of 15 miles per hour.
I'm curious, Alex, could we ask Greg what portion of these collisions involve passenger cars colliding with SUVs?
I'm not an expert in that department. My expertise is pretty much limited to bumper-to-bumper crashes, so you'd have cars that are, you know, like-sized. There's a lot of literature out there on that, and I know that size really does matter. A lot of the five-star ratings you're hearing makes it sound like cars are safe, but as it turns out, they're just stiffer, smaller cars, and in lower speeds, there's more of an elastic collision, so the cars kind of rebound, and it may show very little damage to the car, but show a lot of damage to people inside the cars. And
Greg, we're going to have to take another call. I'm sorry. Sure. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
We have Steve calling us from Exeter, New Hampshire.
Hi. I wanted to get to a point that Professor Carl Bogus made early in the show when he defended lawsuits as good for America by saying that they're necessary as a backup to regulatory decisions and, on matters like corporate misbehavior and medical malpractice and so on. But his defense is not a defense unless you assume that our tort system is going to get the decision right. If a regulatory agency, for example, made the correct decision and a subsequent lawsuit reversed that decision and made the wrong decision, that wouldn't be a good outcome. So what he's doing is implicitly assuming that lawsuits will get decisions right that are made wrongly by other means, like either by regulatory agencies or by some sort of mandatory arbitration.
The caller brings up a really important point, and it is this. Regulatory agencies may tell a manufacturer how to design a product. The courts do not. They're not right or wrong in this. They do not say you must design a product a certain way. What they do say is if your product is unreasonably dangerous, not just dangerous, all products have some degree of danger, but unreasonably dangerous, then you're responsible for the people you injure. And that creates a financial incentive on the manufacturer to try to reduce injuries any way the manufacturer thinks is cost-effective and sensible. So it's the courts don't have to get it right. They aren't design engineers or safety engineers. They simply provide a financial incentive upon manufacturers to do better to reduce injuries.
Thank you, Steve.
No, wait, could I...
Sure, go ahead.
Could I interject there? That isn't quite correct. There's a flip side to that. Jury verdicts may cause higher expenses. They may cause and have caused a lot of corporations to get out of the business of making certain products. And, of course, they may, when you drive up costs, like what the obstetrician talked about earlier, you drive down service. And as she correctly pointed out, for example, a lot of obstetricians are getting out of the business because of the high insurance premiums. And another point is that Professor Bogus didn't defend, he shifted the argument from defending the accuracy of jury verdicts in tort systems to saying that they create this implicit good by making corporations more careful. And, of course, the ultimate effect of that, if you make a corporation more careful or if you drive them out of a business like like new drug developments, the implications of that are unclear. And of course, getting back to the original point, it's no defense of the accuracy of jury verdicts. In fact, either he or another gentleman on your show earlier said that in multimillion-dollar cases, judges reverse juries 74% of the time, which means that somebody is getting it wrong 74% of the time.
No, I did not
either
say
juries
that.
Or either judges or juries.
An important point, I did not say that the judges reverse juries 74% of the time.
Reduced verdicts.
And reduce or eliminate verdicts. Only those. I'm only focusing on the jury verdicts, by the way, that are in excess of $1 million. That is not the case with most jury verdicts. The rate of jury judge agreement is incredibly high. And I guess I also should point out that what we call the tort tax, the amount of the price of products that are raised to account for the liability system overall. Now this does vary industry by industry, but overall is 0.2%.
Steve, thank you for your call and thank you for your thoughts. Connection listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Beth joining us.
Hi, I'm a law student. I just finished my first year, including torts class, and I know one thing that troubled a lot of the students in our class was the role of the tort system in compensating victims and the fact that a lot of victims are not compensated. They don't bring claims, or when they do, they're undercompensated. And we discussed alternative systems, administrative systems through the government. And I was just wondering if your guests could comment on that.
Well, Beth raises a good point. And that may be the case. There are a lot of people who do argue that that people are being undercompensated through the system. My particular view is that the system should not be thought of primarily as a compensation system. There are better ways to construct compensation systems. It is best thought of as a regulatory system. It is a very important regulatory system, and one of the things it does is it brings to light, to public light in public courtrooms, reported by the press, practices, antisocial practices by corporations, reckless practices by corporations, and it's a very powerful regulatory system. There are probably better ways to construct compensatory systems.
Beth, are you disturbed by what you learn in torts class? Do you think it should not be a form of compensation?
I completely agree. I mean, I think it is useful as a regulatory system. It does serve an important purpose in our democracy. But as a compensation system, the record is just horrendous. And I think it is disturbing that a lot of plaintiffs are harmed and just never get compensated.
Mm. Beth, thanks a lot for your call. We have David joining us on the line.
Hello.
Hi, David.
Hi. The point that I wanted to make was one of the things that we've lost sight of in this conversation is the whole public policy underlying this. I mean, corporations are not entitled to limited liability out of thin air. They're granted states pass corporation acts permitting corporations to have limited liability to act in the public interest and also in their shareholders' interest. I think the tort system permits individuals to have some defense against that type of construct where corporations can act as a legal entity. Individuals can make decisions but not be responsible for those decisions. The corporation is responsible for those decisions. Corporation executives typically do not go to jail for the decisions they make. The way to hold them accountable for the decisions is the tort system. And the comment earlier about adopting a Canadian system or the UK system where individuals would have to pay the legal fees of the corporation they sue, I mean, that would essentially put an end to the tort system. How would anybody ever sue General Motors? How would you ever have a Ford Pinto case? How could you ever hold a billion-dollar corporation accountable if Joe Smo had to pay the legal fees for the largest law firm in New York defending a large multinational corporation?
So you agree with Professor Bogus. I mean, you're sort of comfortable with the public policy role.
Absolutely. And the Wall Street Journal published an analysis a few years ago about the whole myth of a litigation explosion and how the insurance industry got together to essentially create a public relations campaign, very effective, by the way, in creating an image in the United States of a litigation explosion. I think he already made the point that was made in the Wall Street Journal article that the explosion in litigation has been between corporations, not by individuals against corporations. I'm not having a lot of particular sympathy for the plight of large corporations. And by the way, I work for one of the largest corporations in Massachusetts.
Thank you, David. Thank you for your comments. Yeah.
I think one of the things that's very American is that not only does the system allow citizens to take on big corporations, but that it implants within the decision-making system a real element of democracy, that is the jury. It is not an uncontrolled element. The jury makes the decision after hearing the evidence. The law is very careful about what they hear. The jury verdicts are reviewed by the trial judge and by the appellate courts. But it is very important, I think, in the culture of our country, that the people have an important role in making the decisions. These are, after all, value-based decisions.
Well, Carl, thank you very much, and thank you for joining us. This is an interesting hour. Carl Bogus is a professor of law at Roger Williams University, and he's the author of the book Why Lawsuits Are Good for America. Earlier in the hour, we had Jack Olander joining us. He's a malpractice attorney and a former president of the Washington, D.C. Bar Association. Likewise, we heard from Joseph Montedonico, a defense attorney with the firm of Montedonico, Hamilton & Altman. Connection listeners, you can continue this litigation conversation on our website. We're at www.theconnection.org. We had help producing this hour from Kim Bichari, Darren Mnuchin, Tim Monroe, and from our interns, Annie Colcord and Tom Jacobois. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Stefan Katsanis, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugars. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Alex Beam. You've been listening to The Connection. This is W.